Welcome to this podcast, where we're going to be talking all about the meaning of value and the recent report that Royal London commissioned with Lang Cat to look at and research what consumers and advisors think of when we talk about value. So this is a very recent report, and it builds on really some work that Royal London's been doing for several years, trying to understand the value of advice, indeed the advice gap, and then looking at the kind of barriers to people taking advice. And particularly we're thinking about value in the context of clients receiving advice now. So we're starting to move that agenda forward. And this is particularly relevant at a time when the regulators, through the Consumer Duty, are very focused on value to clients and customers. So we think it's a very interesting subject, and we're keen to find out a bit more, particularly about what consumers think about value generally, and then how they think about it in terms of advice, and how that contrasts or compares or looks the same as what advisors perceive it to be. With me today, I am very pleased to be joined by Ben Alcock from Continuum, a large and growing advice firm, independent financial advisors, and also Mike Barrett from Lang Cat, who himself was responsible for overseeing the research that was done that supports and underpins this piece of work that we did, and also produced the report on our behalf, and Claire Moffat, who runs our technical team at Royal London, and who spends much of her life speaking to advisors and her team speaking to advisors about the various issues that are current and topical. So thank you all for joining me. And I will hand straight over to you, Mike, if I may, just to open the discussion, talk a little bit about what the research and findings were telling us.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. So I think this always felt like a piece of work which we always wanted to do. So we were naturally pretty happy when you commissioned it and made it happen. The whole subject of kind of looking into value and what consumers actually value from the products or services that they're purchasing has always been something which I think has been really, really important. From I think back to my days working for a provider when we were kind of building propositions ourselves, you kind of need to know, you're hoping you're going to build something that consumers are actually going to think is useful and is going to be value for money for them. And for advisors, they're in a similar position. Their advice services, where they've been building those, when they've been out giving advice to their clients, they've always wanted to make sure that those represent fair value and also, again, are attracting consumers. You want consumers to pay for your products or services. But Consumer Duty, obviously, if I can name drop the regulation into the podcast at this early stage, that's gave it kind of a deeper focus. I think it put it in the forefront of everybody's minds, and in particular the two sides of the outcomes on Consumer Duty, building those products and services with a clear target market in mind, but then making sure that those products and services represent fair value. So I think we, taking that kind of into the research field, I think everyone probably understands that value is subjective, and it's subjective in the environment, in the context that people are making the value judgments. So that old joke around you can drive your old battered car to the airport and then fly in business class, you choose throughout all of the decisions that you make throughout your day what you think represents fair value, how you want to spend your money. And again, I think most people kind of understand that message, but what Consumer Duty made is that there's this need for firms to understand it in more depth, and in particular evidence that they're delivering fair value. So you need to understand, as a consequence of that, what the general population are thinking like. It's really dangerous, I think, for providers, for advisors, for whoever, to start to kind of put their own preconceptions into this when they're working through it from a proposition development point of view and from a regulatory point of view. So the the value, part of the research which we conducted, is asking those questions to a representative sample of the population and saying, okay, this is actually how the population think. So to look through the headlines around that, I think one of the first things, so the initial question which we asked consumers was an open question. How do you define fair value? And from a research point of view, that's quite unusual to lead with a research with an open question up front. It's quite a high barrier sometimes for people to work through. And we deliberately structured that way rather than giving them a list of things to tick on and say, oh, yeah, that looks familiar. And one of the first things that struck us when we were looking through those results was that there was 16% of respondents said they simply don't know. So actually, yeah, we asked them to think about it, and the consequences was that they didn't know actually what's in their mind in terms of fair value. They have no hard and fast preconceptions around it. But then amongst those who did answer, we saw some kind of clear trends starting to come through. And those clear trends started to kind of draw out exactly what do people do value, what is important to you. So the biggest answer that came through, 25% kind of focused on the value-driven side of things. So actually, yeah, you feel happy that you're paying a certain figure for something. You think that it's a competitive price for a product or service. And you're kind of getting what you expect from it as well. If you like kind of softer aspects going through their minds there. There were 16% of the respondents decided that actually it's price for them. So yeah, it's a deal. I've been able to perhaps negotiate a special deal. So I've haggled my plumber and got it down, the price or whatever it might be. And yeah, maybe I've got something little bit extra on top of what is the going rate around that. So maybe a bit of a harder measure coming through around that. But for all consumers, this is kind of what's important to them is kind of a sense of worth. So this product or service you're going to get does the job. It does what you think it's going to do. You're in a better position as a result of doing that. And ultimately, that worth you feel within yourself that you can justify.
Thank you very much, Mike. That's really, it's really interesting. And part of this was to look at both the views of consumers on value, but also the understanding of advisors. And I always acknowledge, rightly, I think, acknowledge that advisors are closer to clients than anyone else in the value chain, if you like. So when the FCA talks about looking through to the end consumer of products and services and what sort of outcomes they have, advisors are very well placed compared to some others that are once, twice, three times removed. What were advisors saying from the research?
Yeah, so we asked advisors and consumers pretty much kind of the same types of questions, really. So we wanted to compare and contrast the responses. And I'm sure you recall we were slightly nervous at the start of the project around what if we discover that advisors are completely misaligned with what the consumer research is saying. And was very kind of relieved to see that wasn't the case coming through. And if you kind of think about it sensibly, then we're what, 12 years since RDR now, so 12 years since advisors have had to convince clients to pay them a fee. And if you weren't able to demonstrate to somebody that represents value for money and is worth paying, you wouldn't be around now. You advisors are successful. They know what they're doing and they do deliver fair value to their clients. So the results were fairly aligned. You ask advisors, what do you think consumers value? And it was peace of mind. It was reassurance. It was help navigating complexity, help through the dark times of kind of life events and all the rest of that stuff. And that mirrored perfectly what the consumer research was saying, particularly those who have already worked with an advisor. There was one area where we did have a misalignment though, and that was just the subject of investment performance. And it's perhaps worth noting that this research was conducted in October last year, when the markets were a lot further south than they are now, thankfully. And actually, speaking now in March, I've been speaking with advisors recently who are saying that the annual reviews they've been conducting recently have been far more pleasant because the markets have had a good 3 months or so. But when we ask advisors, what are the things that consumers value, only 30% of advisors said that investment performance is important, whereas 90% of consumers were saying the same as well. So it's not saying that it's more important than peace of mind and reinsurance, and though both still remain the most important factors from a consumer's point of view, but there's a danger perhaps that advisors might just underestimate the importance of investment returns as well, and as much as particularly kind of the more financial planning led advisors will rightly say that it's kind of out of their control and you can't predict the future and all the rest of that, consumers do attribute some of the overall value to what their portfolio performance chart is saying.
Okay, thank you very much. And it's a really good summary, and it's very interesting because you're right. I mean, there is something about the time at which you do these surveys and what's happening in any given moment, but equally, you know, advisors and consumers were talking to us at that same time and seeing some differences. On the other hand, I suppose I partly think that, you know, when it comes to investment returns and the notion that peace of mind is very high on people's list, they're not necessarily exclusive matters. You know, sometimes it's the peace of mind that, you know, you ride out the storm or a difficult time. But let me turn to you, Ben, because you understand this far better than I do in terms of thinking about the context of value and some of what you've heard from Mike in the context of your business, being somebody who actually deals with clients as opposed to, in my case, theorizing about it. Tell me a bit about what you thought when you heard this.
Well, I think the report is really enlightening and it provides, you know, fantastic insight for us all. And first and foremost, we, to succeed as a profession, to succeed as a business, we have to provide value to our clients. A lot of our business comes from ongoing service clients, and they effectively have to rehire us each year. So we cannot take it for granted. So we have to make sure that we're providing value. And in my views, providing value is being valuable to the client. So the client, you know, wants you and sort of cherishes that relationship. And that is easier when you've had an established relationship with a client, because you build on that trust, you build on that relationship over time, and you develop deeper foundations. It can be a little bit more challenging with a brand new client because they're coming at it from a fresh set of eyes. So you just have to make sure that you are asking the client what they value at outset and prove to the client that you're on their side and you're understanding their needs, you're understanding their goals, and you're putting yourself in the shoes of the client, so that they can see that you're on their side and you want them to succeed. And I totally understand the point from the research which Mike brought up before about there's some potentially a misalignment between how much clients value investment returns when they're you know, considering the value of the relationship and how much advisors do. And I think part of that goes down to, you know, returns are very, very tangible and it's very, very easily measurable. So it's a benchmark that the clients can see and judge it on very, very clearly. Whereas advisors, they, you know, especially when you're dealing with new clients, the advisors know what they do, and they know they do so much more for clients than just setting up an investment and monitoring the investment. They know everything which goes into it, which are intangible. So much of the value we give to clients are intangible. And it's not easily measurable, but without it, you know, the client wouldn't have as much peace of mind or as much confidence as they do. So yes, the clients will value investment returns, and so they should, because ultimately, you know, it's their money, and they want their money to grow. They need their money to grow. But our job is to make sure that we demonstrate to the client that we understand that. And we know how important it's to them, and we never lose sight of the fact that it's the client's money, and we are on the side of the client. So it's in our best interest for our client's money to grow. We want it to succeed. And if it's not working and we can make changes, then we will make changes. So it's very important that the client understands we're on their side and we work for the client effectively. We don't work for any investment house. We work for the client. It's as simple as that. And when markets go down, that is a real opportunity to demonstrate your value to a client. That's when, you know, the client will look back and think, yes, I remember when the market crashed and I was worried about it, but then, you know, unprompted, my financial planner picked up the phone to me and spoke to me about what was happening, made me understand and realize that this is what we spoke about at the beginning. We spoke about the fact that markets will go down at times. We spoke about the fact that, you know, it can be a little bit uncomfortable when it goes down, and potentially you could be worried about it, but it's something to expect and something you will get through. And sometimes the best advice is don't just do something, stand there. And it's very simple for an advisor to say that, but it can be just what the client needs to hear at the time. And you could prevent the client from making a big mistake by panicking and disinvesting at the wrong time. So market falls, you know, they are market returns, market falls, market rises, you know, it's vitally important. And part of our value is being there to make sure the clients understand the journey, and to grow their money, they have to go through, you know, volatility at times. So they need to understand what that is. And it's our job to, you know, demonstrate that to the client.
Thanks, Ben. And you talked about, you know, markets going down, and it's the obvious example, and the one that perhaps, Mike, you partly alluded to in terms of the timing of the research, but also life events generally that clients go through. It's not, you know, it's not just the market volatility, but presumably you have conversations, and the softer side of the value you bring to clients comes into play when they have their life events, you know, sadly bereavements or changes in income or whatever it may be. Is that presumably that's equally true?
So it's an interesting one. So as I said earlier on, we have deep and long lasting relationship with clients, and there can't be, and we understand what value we give. And it's, as I said, it's just explaining that value to the clients. Now, there's not many professions that I can think of who have such a relationship with their clients. The client, you meet your clients on a regular basis. And yes, you talk about the investments, you talk about the protection needs and the retirement planning needs, but you also talk about the person. You get to know the person, they get to know you, they confide in you, they look for you to provide them with support. And, you know, we provide them with that support, and we get to know their circumstances, their situation, their goals, their aspirations, and their fears. And we are, as you said, Jamie, with them for different stages of their life. And we help them to transition into those different phases and stages of their life and prepare for those phases, rather than just coming at it from a unknown perspective. We already know that client. And so, yes, life-changing events like a bereavement, we're there to provide support to help them through that difficult time. Because, you know, when somebody passes away, obviously there's so much which is going on, and sometimes you don't have the space or time to grieve because everything's going on. So if we can sort of help take away some of the pressure with the financial side of things, sorting things out, letting them know what they need to do with the finances and taking some of that burden away from them, then again, that's not something they thought about when they first started the relationship, but it's something which, you know, provides them so much comfort and peace of mind. And then coming to retirement, it can be, you know, a worrying time for people, you know, an uncertain time. And again, we've helped to lead them up to that point in their life so that the transition is easier.
It's really, really interesting. I was talking to somebody earlier today, actually, about, you know, how, you know, advice, it is a profession. I think that perhaps was a day where you could describe it as an industry, pre-RDR, but, you know, it's an advice profession now. And I was talking about the example, comparing it with the legal profession. My interactions with the legal profession over the years have always been about buying or selling a house. I'm glad to say not for criminal matters. But equally, and occasionally, I've made a will, changed that will, or made a power of attorney. But it's quite transactional. You know, I don't do an annual legal review with my lawyer. You know, I have a legal firm that I would go to, but only when I require them. That's quite different. Whereas, as you say, it's quite normal to do an annual or even more frequent financial review. But thank you very much, Ben. And I'll come back to you with some more questions. Claire, let me come to you for a second. You work with me at Royal London, and you run the technical team. You spend an awful lot of time working with advisors. What do you think when you hear what we've said about value and what you pick up day to day?
So I think probably similar themes to have just been mentioned by Ben. The team are out and about. We help with the technicality of what's going on in the advice world. And, you know, there's a huge amount going on just now. And we know that from the research, overall advisors having the relevant skills and experience, well, that's second only to giving advice in the client's best interest. But I think what comes across sometimes is we're talking to advisors who are getting to grips with lots of pension changes. They are great at helping their clients, but sometimes they're not always good at articulating everything that they do. And this holistic approach to financial planning, I think some of the time it is about kind of fully explaining to clients what they do. So, you know, if you just say you give pensions and tax advice, that's not covering the fact that you're looking at not only the rest of someone's life, might often couples, you might be looking at, you know, passing on wealth to generations. And, you know, you mentioned kind of the difference between sort of legal being transactional, you know, and in my previous life, I was a lawyer. That's very much it. You did the job. It was on a matter basis. You move on. That's it. You might not ever engage again. And financial advice is the opposite of that, because you are looking at, you know, the rest of someone's life. And it is about that trusted relationship. I think really being able to articulate those, especially those non-financial benefits, is so important. And I think sort of linked to that is, you know, we carried out some gender research last year as well. And it's been really interesting talking to advisors about that and some of the kind of questions that have come up. And so when I was looking at this research, I wanted to have a look particularly about the differences when we thought about age and gender. And one of, you know, one of the points was that from financial services in general, women value emotional support, things like trust and good service more. Men rate these, but they kind of lean more to the monetary aspects. And to me, this is key. Like, men and women are different, so we have to think about it a bit differently. When we look at younger people, good service was crucial to them. But when we looked at, you know, what women want from financial advisors, again, you know, it was advice in their best interest, skills and knowledge, but also an advisor who communicates and explains financial concepts really well. So I think it was about 25% of women said this compared to 18% of men. And actually for those under 34, it was about someone being approachable and easy to talk to. So I think, you know, often it is a man who has most of the wealth. And even if it's a couple, that, you know, that's kind of the way it is. I think the average advised client is a man in his late 50s. But we know that there's going to be a lot of wealth passing on. So that could be to a spouse. It could be passing on intergenerationally. And actually, some of the conversations I've had with advisors is about how to kind of deal with conversations with couples when actually what they need from that advice relationship is different. The way things are explained, the information they need to process these kind of things. And we want people to feel comfortable with an advisor so that when bad things do happen, there is a bereavement, they stay with that trusted advisor and they're not sort of feeling uncomfortable and want to move on and change advisors. So I think it's hugely important that you know, that sort of difference between what men and women and perhaps younger family members, what they need and how that relationship can develop, I think that's really important. And looking from a different aspect, one of the other things that we've been asked quite a lot about is about, well, how much should you charge? So all part of this kind of value thing. And actually, specifically in the workplace pension space, this has been coming up kind of more and more. And I think, you know, we're seeing a lot more advisors coming into the workplace pension market. And value's different there as well, because we're thinking, you know, the employer is the client, but we've also got the scheme members as well. And it's their outcomes that are going to be that measure of whether kind of value's been achieved. So value is intertwined with price, but it is always back to this that, you know, if we see sort of two broadly similar products or services, then we want to know, or we're not going to know which one gives the greatest value if we don't know the price of each. But we also want to know exactly what they do. So I think sometimes we've been having conversations with advisors about just helping them to kind of really articulate again exactly what they're offering and the detail of that, and breaking that down sometimes to its kind of constituent parts so that so that employers know what's being offered, you know, and not just, I think sometimes advisors will just kind of almost cover 10 different tasks in one. And actually, by explaining all those different tasks, it's showing what, you know, what a great job they're doing by considering all of these different things. Because we want clients to be in that kind of fully informed position, knowing the service, knowing the cost, and then that helps them kind of determine the value as well.
It's really interesting, Claire. Thank you very much. And let me just briefly, if I may, round back to you, Mike. I mean, the third element of the research was getting some views on providers, and it would be remiss of me not to mention that, being hailing from a provider myself. Do you want to say a few words about that?
Yes, I will. And just very briefly, just to kind of take it back to reinforce what Claire said about the gender split that existed through some of the research, this point around communication to clients was really interesting, and it kind of fed us into some of the other research which we've done outside of this paper around the advice gap. Broadly speaking, the communications are hugely important because of the nature of what advisors are doing. It's now hugely important to evidence that consumers are understanding that as a result of Consumer Duty. But yeah, you are much more likely to encounter somebody who's overconfident about their own ability and doesn't want to listen to what is going on and thinks that they can do this all themselves if they are male. And that will represent a barrier to advice as well. I don't need to pay Ben to do it. I can do this all myself. As my plumber, I was saying to them when I had attempted to repair the leak and then had to get a professional in, all of those types of things. And as Claire said on a moment ago, you are much more likely to encounter somebody who needs real reassurance and wants you to explain it clearly to them as to what is going on, and so that they can trust you if they are female. And that's not to say that those don't kind of straddle either side of the gender split, but that's the one area which does come out on the research, that there is a very clear, noticeable difference between the two genders. But to take it back to providers, yes, as you would expect for providers, there's maybe kind of a little bit kind of some harder measures which are out there, I'm afraid. So price does come up a little bit harder around this, but also customer service, the quality of kind of communications. So aligned to the things which we just talked about as well. People want to be able to kind of make their own decisions or to validate the decisions that somebody else has made on their behalf. And I think also the final area is kind of the sense of security. And again, we can break that down to kind of perhaps having larger, more recognizable brands as well. We talk with other clients about kind of things, just simple things like digital footprints. What happens when I Google the company's name? And yeah, for larger organizations, and you invest a lot of money into your brand reputation and your visibility of brand and all the rest of that stuff, and that's, there is an importance to that as well. That's not money completely wasted, I don't think so.
Indeed, thank you. And yeah, it's important to understand that. I mean, we for our part deal, you know, most of what we do is through financial advisors, but nonetheless the financial advisors we deal with would, I'm sure, say that it's easier advising.
We asked advisors specifically about that, and there's a conversation that I recall instantly around that, saying that part of the conversation they have with their clients is that I use Royal London, and I'm afraid it wasn't actually Royal London they said, but I use Royal London, and I tell my clients that if I don't work for you as an advisor, you can go and find another advisor down the road who will be able to use Royal London and can access Royal London, and it's an organisation that you will recognise as well. So that brand importance for some advisors, not all, is something which they have as part of their conversations with their clients.
Okay, yeah, very interesting. Okay, thank you. And let me come on to the Consumer Duty. We've mentioned it a couple of times, but it is still ever present. So, you know, the first stage of Consumer Duty was last July, the second stage on legacy products this July. But more importantly, I think, a cultural switch over this period switch is the wrong word, evolution, if you like. I mean, and I always talk about it as a move from just treating customers fairly, as good as that and right as that is, but moving from treating customers fairly to treating them well and proving it, really, looking through into the kind of outcomes they have. But in the context of value, Ben, let me come to you first, just in the context of the discussion we're having around value. I mean, has the consumer duty changed the way you think about that with your clients?
So consumer duty is we see a continuum. We see consumer duty as a real big opportunity to really demonstrate and showcase how we're looking after clients and how much we do value the clients. So Claire made the point about one of the biggest changes from the advisor's perspective is evidencing the value you give. And I think sometimes advisors don't even realize how much they do within their role. It's when you do create a plan for a client, because that's something you do every day, you forget how much does go into it. And if you break it down to the granular details, as Claire was saying, then it's quite amazing how much we actually do. And it's about demonstrating that to the client so they understand what goes into it. So making better notes about what we do for clients. So for instance, we would now start writing down every piece of work we do for the client. We really start breaking down, just making notes of it, just evidence to ourselves as much as the client. And we've also had at Continuum, we've had many, many, many meetings about consumer duty. We've had external speakers in to talk to us about it. And just to really just emphasize the importance of it, and that is an opportunity. I do think many, many firms out there have been living by the spirit of consumer duty before it even had a name, because our clients, as I made the point before, they do rehire us every year. They don't have to pay ongoing service. They'll only get, I say to my clients, you only pay us an ongoing service fee for as long as you want and for as long as you value the service that we give you. And if we're ever falling short of that, then you need to tell us and we'll do something about it. Or you can leave without any notice period. So we have to keep demonstrating that value to the client day in, day out, year in, year out, to make sure that our clients want to stay with us. And they'll only stay with us if we provide value and if we are valuable to them. So it's so important, the consumer duty. And see it as a big opportunity just to keep yourself sharp with the value you are giving and to make sure that you understand the value you give and your clients understand the value that you're giving them.
Really interesting and good to hear. Certainly aligned on the belief that it's an opportunity as much as it's a significant piece of work. Claire, anything to add on consumer duty?
Yeah, it was really interesting to see some of the comments in the research, and that kind of aligns with some of the conversations that I've had where you're out and about and advisors have been sending questionnaires out to their clients and actually asking clients what they value, then looking at that with the client, because I think this does then highlight, well, actually, maybe it is about articulating something in a different way, or maybe tailoring the service to the elements which that client values more. So I think it's really about good conversations and especially about those sort of non-financial benefits. I think, it was mentioned earlier about investment returns. And I think actually that kind of being able to explain to clients and help them understand that actually, you might have had a loss this year of 1%, but without all of the work done in the background, then that could have been a much bigger loss. And that's really, really important. So I think it is kind of helping customers, clients to understand that. And one example that I wanted to give, which we're finding more and more, is that in the wealth space, advisors want to know a lot more about protection. So we're talking about protection more, but protection used to be one of those areas where, you sold a product that kind of then you would never speak to the client again type thing. Potentially you'd sell them a life policy and that would be it. And the world has really, really changed, that it's not just about price, and the regulator said it's not just about price. That can't be at the expense of other factors. So actually, when we've got things like added value services that are going to help your clients have that, maintain a healthy lifestyle, will help in times of crisis, there's virtual GPs, all of these kind of things, bereavement support. And that's not just support for that one person, it can be for the whole family too. And actually, showing the value of having an advisor involved in protection, because if someone buys a protection product online, they don't have the knowledge that an advisor has. They don't have the ability to look at flexible products that will change as a client's family changes, their career changes, their lifestyle, for example. So I think it's, you know, that's a kind of massive difference. That value that the advisor brings is to a huge amount more. And it's back to that thing that actually nobody really wants a protection product to be paying out. That's, you know, but when the worst does happen, you want the right person in your corner taking all of the stress when you are at your most vulnerable. You know, that is so important and such a huge value for clients. So, you know, those days of just kind of buying a product like that are gone, and advisors, that's where, you know, they can be showing a huge amount of value and engaging with clients and giving that support and knowledge.
Really, really interesting. Thank you for that perspective. And I mean, sticking with the theme and on consumer duty, but kind of moving it forward to some of the things we're seeing today. And Michael, maybe come to you on this first. I mean, we've seen now the regulator, in fact, through the research initially, we saw that a number of advice firms had actually changed their fee model, partly in response to the, you know, reviewing what they were doing under the auspices of the consumer duty. But more recently, in recent days, really, we've seen a renewed focus from the regulator on, you know, ongoing advice fees and the, you know, the relative merits, making sure that there is a kind of underlying service being provided in return for those fees, I guess, the most simplistic way of looking at that. I mean, without getting into any specific examples, Mike, but I mean, any thoughts on where that's headed and what it means for us?
Yeah, it seems to me that there's kind of two parts of that conversation, two parts to the answer. There is it appears that there is a small percentage of the advice community, and I'm quite deliberately not using the word profession in this instance, who appear to be taking on service fees and doing little if nothing for the end client. And I think the advice profession as a whole will kind of want to rightly distance themselves from those individuals. If you're getting paid for something and you don't do it, then I think everyone kind of agrees it's a fair cop. You deserve the consequences that come your way. But I think the more interesting and potentially dangerous area from the regulator's point of view is the second bit, where you are delivering your services and whether the regulator thinks that those services represent fair value based on their own definition of fair value. But going back to our research, I think as Claire mentioned, we saw some surprisingly positive sentiment towards consumer duty, considering we were speaking to advisors in the month or so after they'd actually implemented it. And most of that, would be something like two thirds of the advisors we spoke with were actually really kind of on board with it. It's perhaps been a bit of work to get it over the line, but the sentiment is right there. Advisors tend to want to do the right thing around this. But they're crying out a little bit for a little bit more kind of detailed guidance, I think, around exactly how do we evidence that we are delivering fair value to our clients. And we said it in November when we launched the report that we would urge the regulator to put some kind of good and poor practice examples out into the advice profession to help them with that. And sadly, that hasn't really happened yet. But I wonder whether it's kind of an additional stage beyond that kind of helping people getting over the line, on the assumption that they're going to get, as you say, a whole load of data fairly soon on their first wave of annual reports, which will hopefully evidence that the advice profession is delivering fair value to their clients. Then I think actually the regulator should help and get that message out there more broadly. So actually, yes, there has been these regulatory initiatives, and there is now an even higher bar for all providers, for everyone in financial services to hit. And the advice profession, if their results show that they are delivering fair value, then the regulator should help promote the value of advice a little bit more, I think. And it's not necessarily for them to sell advisors and to sell the businesses, but there's a clear, I think, economic benefit to wider society if more people do take control of their financial futures and do take advice. And yeah, just a couple of steps in that direction, I think, from the regulator, if nothing else, just to kind of sell the benefits of the work which they've done, to say, yeah, we keep an eye on the advice sector and they are delivering fair value. That message, I don't think has got out there enough.
Thank you, Mike. And Ben, I'll come to you briefly for anything that you want to add on that, in terms of how you think about it in the context of your business and your clients. Anything to add?
Yeah, I just think that going back to one of the earlier points about, you know, clients, you know, looking at the investment returns potentially more so than the advisors. As I said earlier on, that's like a very measurable yardstick, really, to demonstrate something. And you can also demonstrate it via like the logging your annual reviews and showing how often you're meeting with the client. The one of the key though is, how do you measure the confidence, the clarity, and the conviction and the peace of mind that we provide to clients? How do you measure that? Because the importance of that is immeasurable, really. And it's going back to Mike's point, it'd be, you know, some guidance about how do you actually evidence that, because it's so important. And people sometimes only miss something when it's not there, but whilst it's there, because it's happening all the time in your relationship with a client, you know, it's maybe it's not as noticed, but when people sit back and reflect, they think, yes, this is important, and good financial planners provide us with this. And I think it'd be interesting to give a questionnaire to the clients. Don't just assume, going back to Mike's earlier point, don't assume we know what the clients value, because, you know, you might think that's what I think they value, but ask the clients what they value at the beginning of a relationship. And then I think it'd be interesting to see also, you know, a year down the line, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line, ask the same questions. What do you value now? And I think you'd see a change in what they value once they've experienced the relationship with the financial plan. And that perhaps that's a good way to sort of demonstrate it. And you can maybe capture some more of the soft facts and the intangibles that way.
It's really interesting. And I will close it there with the theme of, how do you measure the immeasurable? I really like that point, which is very well made. Okay, listen, thank you very much for joining me for what was turned out to be, I think, a very interesting discussion. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Claire. We will close it there. And the report, if anybody wants to see, The Meaning of Value, is available both on the Landcat website, but also Royal London's website. So please have a look if you are interested in finding out more. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you found it useful.